Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
Today's podcast will be a two-parter. First, Zach and I will discuss, given the U.S.-Africa summit this year, this week in D.C., Zach and I will discuss the growing competition and cooperation between the U.S. and China on the African continent, following which we'll do a quick preview of the upcoming ASEAN Regional Forum, which is sure to include several important issues that are currently developing in the Asia-Pacific region. So to start off with, a lot of us have been thinking about Africa this week, particularly because most African leaders are in Washington this week for the U.S.-Africa summit. And essentially, it seems that the biggest issue in the room in D.C. between President Obama and these African leaders is China's current presence in Africa. I mean, China has more than twice the trade with Africa compared to the United States. And essentially, the U.S. is playing catch-up. And it's a very tough sell for the United States to convince African leaders that the United States is a more valuable partner than China. And there's a variety of reasons for that. A lot of it simply has to do with the fact that China's approach to Africa, which has often been checkbook diplomacy, is significantly less interested in applying conditions when it comes to human rights. Essentially, Chinese money comes with very few strings attached, and that's very appealing for African countries, which don't have to deal with kind of patronizing conditionality from the West when it comes to using their development money. So in that sense, you know, China has begun to far outpace the United States in Africa. So Zach, what are your thoughts? I mean, to me, it seems like it's an incredibly tough sell for the United States at this point, barring some sort of major change in how the United States sees its aid money being used in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think, first of all, it's good for African countries, especially these East African countries that are kind of positioned. They've been growing steadily in. There's some stability in a lot of those countries. So I think having all these countries, it's not just the U.S. and China. There's India's competing for Africa. Japan's been increasing its investments again. So I think there's a lot of interest that's sort of half because of the growth potential in Africa and half because of the geopolitical competition between like the U.S. and China, Japan and China, India and China. So I think it's great for Africa, but I agree with your assessment. I don't think this summit's great and, you know, a lot of publicity. It's all I've been hearing about in D.C. this week, but I don't think it's realistic the U.S. is going to catch up with China. China's trade last year was like, with Africa, was $210 billion compared to $85 billion by the U.S. And keep in mind that China just passed U.S. in overall trade to Africa in 2009, so it's already in the over 5 years, it's more than, you know, it now is well over double what the U.S. does in trade. There's a lot less known about China's foreign direct investment in Africa because there's not a lot of transparency, which is one of the U.S. criticisms. But Quartz reported yesterday that less than 1% of U.S. FDI investment goes to Africa, and near 3-4% of China's goes to Africa. So even on a relative basis, it looks like China's more interested in Africa. The U.S. also has declining interest in Africa because it used to import a decent amount of oil from countries like Nigeria. And that's pretty much all dried up because of the shale revolution. I just don't think also the U.S. U.S. has somewhat has like an ADHD. U.S. foreign policy is sort of ADHD where it just goes from crisis to crisis. I don't think despite this big summit and the trip by Obama last summer, I don't think the U.S. can really sustain its interest long enough to compete with China and Africa. And I think that as you mentioned, it's trying to portray itself as a better partner to Africa because the Obama administration is because of. It's not just about getting resources. It's about improving democracy, human rights, and governance, and all those things. But, I mean, I don't think a lot of African leaders, I mean, especially, you know, most of them aren't really democratic. Even the ones that have elections aren't, like, hugely democratic. So I don't think this is, like, what they're not going to be that interested in, about, you know, getting criticized about human rights and stuff.
Right.
So I think that China's actually better positioned because it doesn't care as much about these things. It might be better for Africa if these leaders did care, but you know, foreign policy is conducted mainly through leaders, so I think that's a huge problem for the U.S. And I also think U.S. is going to be focused too much on security. I mean, it's been very, I would say, rapidly expanding its military involvement in the region. It's still very small, but there's been a lot of deployments and a lot of bases being built, and it's focusing a lot on this terrorism in North Africa. And security traditionally trumps economics in U.S. foreign policy, at least in the post-Cold War era.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up. It's a matter of priorities. When you think about U.S. foreign policy priorities in Africa, you think about issues like al-Shabaab, you know, northern African instability in places like Libya, Tunisia, Egypt. You think about Mali and the Tuareg rebels there. You think about Sudan, Central African Republic. I mean, you know, there are a lot of security issues, and I think the United States is keener to essentially stabilize those than become a reliable economic partner for Africa. And that's definitely something that's holding the United States back, and has held it back. And, you know, for China, it absolutely makes sense. I mean, you also look at the historical legacy here on both sides. I mean, for the United States, Africa was a bit of a Cold War playground. And for China, you know, China likes to talk about its sort of post-colonial solidarity with Africa. I mean, a lot of African countries participate in, like, the non-aligned movement. And China essentially sees itself not as, you know, a colonizer. That's actually something China is very sensitive about. Accusations of neocolonialism are really sensitive in China, especially when you talk about what China is doing in Africa these days. So I think China kind of sees itself as a helper for the African countries without any sort of ulterior motives when it comes to human rights or security. And I think that, again, makes its capital very, very appealing for a lot of African leaders.
Absolutely. But I do think that actually might be a problem. I mean, the U.S. used to see itself as the same way, as a non-colonial power, a former colony, in fact. But I think as China rises, it will definitely be seen more and more as a colonial power, because that's just kind of how, you know, foreign powers with a lot of influence through its size of its economy mainly are seen. And I do think that would be one of the main challenges for China over the coming years in Africa. It will be to not be seen, especially as the U.S. maybe even decreases its involvement, or at least relatively compared to China. China will probably be seen more and more as the main sort of neo-colonial power. And I think Chinese leaders are very conscious of this, I think. When they go to Africa, I remember President Xi was there, and I think Premier Li visited too. And they always talk about how China's not a colonial power, as you just kind of hinted at. So I do want to point out there's a piece of commentary in the Chinese state media that pointed out that Obama, despite his African heritage or whatever, doesn't visit Africa as much as China's leaders. It was very kind of racist, the whole comment, but it did illustrate again that China does is – when the U.S., like, whether it's the Secretary of State or President, goes over to Africa, it's this huge, huge thing. When, you know, China's foreign minister goes over, it's a lot less big an ordeal because it's more frequent. And I think China just has more stable or more frequent, consistent diplomacy in Africa. And also, finally, I just want to say that I think China, the fact that China just modernized itself, I think positions it. I went to a event at the Center for International Development in D.C., I think that's the name of the think tank, last year about a new database about China aid in Africa. And there was an African leader that said that when U.S. diplomats come to Africa to help it, like, develop, they, like, come and they ask, like, what African leaders need. When Chinese diplomats will come survey something and leave the place and come back, you know, a few hours later with what they need. Like, one time he brought the example that they needed chairs, and the Chinese diplomats just kind of looked in the meeting area, realized they needed chairs, and brought them. Well, the U.S. government was trying to figure out why they didn't have chairs or whatever. So I just think that China, in a lot of ways, is better positioned.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, I've seen a little bit of that, too. I mean, recently I was at a track, too, in the U.K. About the Commonwealth, and these were, you know, Commonwealth countries. Again, a lot of African countries are members of the Commonwealth, the older British dominions. And they were discussing, a lot of African leaders were actually saying exactly that about China and why it's so difficult for African countries to essentially, you know, resist the allure of Chinese capital. It's simply because China is very easy to work with on development issues. I wanted to bring up one issue, actually, that's looking to be a bit of a game changer in international development in Africa if it does pan out. So China and the U.S., you know, while they are competing in Africa, China's actually put out a proposal inviting the United States to cooperate with it. And this is specifically focused on a $12 billion dam project in the Congo. But more generally, I think it's really interesting that, you know, China is taking this move to invite the United States to cooperate with Africa. I mean, especially as, you know, tensions are high between these two countries in the Asia Pacific. I mean, we saw that at the Strategic and Economic Dialogue earlier this year. I mean, do you think that cooperating in a place like Africa, or maybe even in the Middle East, could help the United States and China come together bilaterally more generally?
Yeah, well, you know, because I've discussed before, I think that I've been writing a piece about the U.S., how China and U.S. should cooperate in the Middle East, because I think their interests are aligned. So I think, I mean, my view is that it's going to be easier for the two countries to cooperate outside of the Asia-Pacific than it is going to be in the Asia-Pacific, just because of I think their interests are mostly opposed in the Asia-Pacific, unless you just say something vague like peace. So I think, yeah, it's an interesting proposal by China. I wonder how the U.S. is going to respond, because the U.S. this week has all but basically positioned itself as, like, diametrically different than China as far as, like, what kind of relationship it wants with Africa. So it'll be interesting to see if it actually takes on this proposal. I suppose the actual terms weren't really mentioned in the Financial Times report. Like, would it be Chinese companies that are building this dam in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or would it be African firms, or you know, a lot of the details I don't think were in the report. Am I right on that? You wrote a piece about this. What is your view?
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, not only because of this week, but more generally, I think there'll be a lot of opposition to cooperating with China and Africa. I think the United States, you know, insofar as U.S. policy is based on ideas and values, I think it'll be very difficult for the United States to cooperate with China off the bat. I do see, you know, the possibility for this to become somewhat of a theme in bilateral negotiations between the U.S. and China, perhaps over the next year or two. And maybe it's something that could occur in the future. But I think a lot of people are you know, excited by the potential of this for international development, because, you know, if something like this does pan out and expands to include other projects, it's only going to benefit African countries. So I think we'll have to keep an eye on this and see where it goes from here.
Yeah, if I could just say one more thing I thought that was I was really surprised this came – this sounds like something that would come from the U.S. side. I remember China's Middle East envoy said last year, it was only really reported, we report on it, and then the Chinese language press did, that the U.S. had asked China to cooperate more in the Middle East, especially the Middle East peace process. But this is, like, I think this is very significant, and it shows China taking the initiative on something like this, and wanting to cooperate, reaching out to the U.S. I'm interested in why this came about, because it's just not really characteristically China, in my view. So, but I think, like you said, the main theme of all this competition from the EU to Asia, the U.S. and Africa is that Africa stands to benefit a lot by playing these powers against each other.
Yeah, I mean, one theory I have to explain is that, you know, China wants to demonstrate its dominance in Africa by inviting the United States instead of the other way around. I mean, it is the reality on the ground. And this isn't really an example of, you know, Beijing taking an international leadership role on some sort of normative issue. It's simply China saying, look, we're the bigger power in Africa, so if you want to get involved, then we'd be happy to work with you. And I think that sends, you know, somewhat of a condescending message to the United States, but I think it works from Beijing's perspective.
But it didn't announce this publicly, really.
I mean, yeah, no. It's been pretty hush hush, I think, so far.
Yeah, because it was proposed last month at the Strategic Economic Dialogue, and then given that it leaked to the Financial Times, it's probably not a Chinese source. It's probably a U.S. source, if anyone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll have to keep an eye on it, though. It definitely looks like an interesting trend. Anyways, let's you know, pivot to Asia, as you might say, and talk a bit about the ASEAN Regional Forum. So this is coming up this week in Nay Pyi Taw, Myanmar. Myanmar will actually be hosting this for the first time, and it's a bit of a significant event for that country, which has traditionally been sort of sidelined within ASEAN due to its government, but due to recent reforms, Myanmar is playing a much larger role within ASEAN and in the Asia Pacific more generally. So the ARF is traditionally, you know, a bit of a lead up into the East Asia Summit, which will actually take place later this year in November. And a lot has changed in the Asia Pacific region in the past year, not least in the South China and East China Seas, which will concern all powers. But Zach, do you want to just run us through, you know, a few of the changes we've seen in this region over the year and how they'll sort of come into play at the ARF later this week?
Well, I mean, I don't think we've seen any fundamental shifts. The crisis is between China and the Philippines, and especially China and Vietnam have really deepened. There's a lot more animosity. I think the East China are the air defense, the ADIZ in the East China Sea has unnerved a lot of ASEAN countries, because they expect the one to be announced in the South China Sea. Indonesia has really been kind of pulled into the South China Sea dispute reluctantly, based on maps China's published. So it's more, its military especially seems more ready to take on a more proactive role in trying to solve the South China Sea issue. The U.S. has hardened its position, especially after the East China Sea ADIZ. And so we're seeing now the Philippines is – and the Philippines is also bringing China to court. I don't know if that was – that was officially going on last year. I can't remember exactly when they filed. I think they filed before the Asian Regional Forum last year. But in any case, what looks like it's going to happen, it looks like the South China Sea is going to be one of the major issues again this year. The Philippines has a three-part proposal. It's kind of been bringing around the Southeast Asia to different nations to get support for. It basically calls for a temporary halt to all provocations, and then medium term, like, I forget exactly the three stages, but the first one would be a halt, voluntary halt by the nations in not provoking other nations in the South China Sea. And this is, the U.S. has gotten behind this.
Yeah, it's also specifically about building projects, right? Because China actually rebutted it. They said that they're not going to have any of that. They're going to build things wherever and whenever they want in the South China Sea, essentially. That's a big
part
of it. Yeah.
Good point, yeah, because they've been building a lot on these islands. They're basically building up military bases so they can sustain longer patrols. That's really China's problem in the South China Sea is it's big and far away compared to the East China Sea, or at least those islands that it's disputing with Japan. So it needs to figure out, it needs to acquire military capabilities to sustain more patrols there for longer periods of time. So it's building up these islands, which is very worrisome to nations like of the Philippines. And also Australia seems to be getting more involved in calling out China in the South China Sea issue too, because now China's coming closer to it also.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, my expectations for the ARF this year aren't, I mean, honestly, aren't that high. I mean, I'm kind of picturing, you know, like you said, I agree with you that China is going to be at the center of this at the ARF. But, you know, I'm kind of expecting the outcomes and the tone of the discussion at the ARF this year to be somewhere between Shangri-La, which maybe was a little bit too colorful, and the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue, which, you know, was essentially pretty dull and neutral. I think we're going to see something in the middle there. Essentially, I'm expecting gridlock, China to be completely unwilling to accept any ASEAN proposals. I guess the one kind of question mark that's still stands out is the extent to which ASEAN can come together and forge any sort of consensus at this point. Because, you know, we've noted this before, that ASEAN is split when it comes to nautical issues, when it comes to issues relating to its relations with China. Essentially, the countries that have disputes with China are significantly more interested in resolving this right now than the other countries are. Indonesia has come around more to the side of these other countries that are trying to work out disputes with China. But overall, ASEAN seems to have a tough time forging a consensus.
Yeah, and the 2011 or 2012 Asian Regional Forum, ASEAN Regional Forum, they actually didn't. That was the time they didn't have a declaration at the end, a joint declaration, and that I saw the behind the scene notes from the ASEAN foreign ministers in Cambodia was basically the sole holdout. I think it really raises the question if more and more, especially if there's gridlock, as you and I think I expected this this weekend, is ASEAN really the right forum to deal with the South China Sea issue? Because, I mean, not all these nations are involved in it. I mean, I think it almost, at some point, there's probably going to be a coalition of the willing, basically, to take the term from the U.S. and the Middle East, where a lot of these maritime nations, and not even just the ones in Southeast Asia, but also Australia, Japan, the U.S., are going to, and maybe even India, are going to come together and deal with this somewhere outside of ASEAN. Because if ASEAN can't deal with the issue on a unified basis, then, like, you know, I think that there's going to be an alternative is going to emerge. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, you know, I think that there is a possibility, but right now, I mean, I think all the countries are still interested in working through the ASEAN mechanism. I mean, you have the Code of Conduct, and I mean, the Declaration on Conduct, the 2002 document, which is essentially pretty much the basis of what they're working with these days. But it looks like, you know, there's going to be a long way to go, and particularly as tensions rise, and, you know, essentially, you know, blood pressures rise across the region, particularly between Vietnam and the Philippines, I think it's only going to get more difficult. And I think, you know, either we will see over the next 6 months, you know, there might be a repeat of something like the oil rig crisis between China and Vietnam, and that could lead to potentially, you know, conflict between these two countries. And that, I think, would change the playground right now in the South China Sea. But so far, I think it's going to be ASEAN that's going to be the main forum for this, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I think you're right for the time being, but I just think that, I mean, I don't really see ASEAN, some of these ASEAN nations, particularly Cambodia, coming around to really dealing with China on the issue, and I think it's going to need to be dealt with, because like you said, tensions are rising. I just at one point do I think, my question is, at what point do we stop trying to push this through ASEAN and try to find an alternative path. I'd also note that two things about the U.S. position. One, Obama's comments in The Economist, which are kind of mirroring other people, other administration officials' comments. Basically, he said over the week, in an article published over the weekend or an interview, that you got to be firm with China. That's the only being firm with China works. And I think this is a position from my talks with people that is increasingly being taken by members of the Obama administration or Obama's larger circle of the foreign policy community in D.C. is that you need to be firm with China. Otherwise, they're going to see it as weakness. And Australia actually said this too. So I thought that was interesting. But at the same time, Danny Russell has now said twice in a week, Danny Russell's the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, he's reiterated twice very clearly this week that we think that all sides are basically – that no one party is to blame for all the recent flare-ups in the South China Sea, and that all party has some blame, some part of the blame. So the U.S. is still really not taking Vietnam or the Philippines side. It's really trying to be neutral, which doesn't seem to be buying much goodwill from China, but it is but it's probably causing a lot of anger in the Philippines and Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, to specify Russell's comments, I have the quote here, which is actually interesting. I think there's a distinction that he makes. He says, you know, we are neutral on the issue of sovereignty, but we are not neutral, however, on the issue of behavior. And I think that that's kind of – that I think does put the onus a bit on China to change its behavior a bit. I mean, obviously, it's far from calling out China explicitly. But, you know, then he goes on to say that and that means all claimants have the obligation to clarify their claims in a peaceful manner that is consistent with international law, including the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. So I think the United States is starting to, you know, slowly come around.
That's been this position for the U.S. position for a while. I wasn't really talking about that part of that seems consistent with me. I'm trying to pull up the quote now that he said. It was in response to a question. He really emphasized that that they're not blaming any side, they're not taking any side, and all parties are really to share blame, which I just think that shows the U.S. just continually wants to position itself. Oh, he said no nation is solely responsible for the state of tension in the region, I don't know. I thought that was kind of significant. It just kind of shows that the U.S. is really trying to be neutral still and not taking either party's side.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have to, you know, do another podcast after the ASEAN Regional Forum to essentially take a look at the outcomes. I think that's where we'll find out if, you know, I think it'd be another data point to add to our analysis of whether ASEAN is capable of resolving these disputes or if it needs to go somewhere else, like you said.
Yeah.
Anyways, thanks a lot for listening. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks.